Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History.
Ukrainian Settlement at Seymour Arm by Estelle Noakes. Free land was the incentive that brought immigrants from the oppressed Ukraine to Canada. The first move of the Ukrainian people into the Shuswap and Okanagan happened in 1919. They had first settled in Manitoba, but found the winters too harsh and the land unsuitable. They were easy prey for land speculators. The families were convinced by the Schwab Land Company to sell their farms in Manitoba for $25 an acre and buy land in Seymour for $200 an acre. The Ukrainian families arrived in Sikkimoose by train and were taken by boat to Seymour Arm. These settlers were agriculture people, and the land they were sold in Seymour was virtually useless for their purposes. There was no other work, and goods had to be shipped at some expense from Sikkimoose by barge. The families had been led to believe they were buying land with rich soil, bountiful water supplies, and year-round sunshine. Disillusioned and desolate, they were forced to spend the winter in the shacks left by the previous settlers. The Jablonski family lost an infant child over the winter. He is buried in the old graveyard. Some of the men did find a little work in the logging industry. It must have been a depressing period for these industrious people, but they brought music, dancing, and new life to the Seymour area for the short time they were there. In the spring, they sent a delegate, Mr. Coast Sherba, back to Sarta, Manitoba, to negotiate with the Schwab Land Company that had swindled them, demanding a suitable location elsewhere. The company found land for them at Grinrod, owned by Mr. Carlin. Among the Ukrainian family names were Jablonskis, Elinskis, Bugaras, Savitkis, Romaniks, Hasmachuks, Pidhernis, Smooks, Barans, Bohanas, and Sherbas. The Ukrainians moved to Grinrod. These hard-working people settled in, clearing land and building homes, but a further swindle awaited them. The Schwab Land Company had only made a down payment on the land, had not paid the rest. The Ukrainians would have to come up with $30 an acre. Many who did not have the money to pay were forced again to move, and descendants of these families can still be found in the Grinrod area.
Klasha Van Guens, Living by Example. This story was written by Estelle Noakes and is read by Estelle Noakes from interviews with Klasha. Klasha was a wonderful example of her own philosophy on living a happy and healthy life as actively as possible, both physically and mentally. She was mother to two daughters, Inika and Marion, grandmother to Kathleen, and great-grandmother to Colby. Born in Holland in 1919, Klasha's young years were filled with sports. She excelled at track and field and won many awards. She began ballroom dancing at the age of 15 and learned to knit, sew, and crochet. Other activities included skating, tennis, and theater productions. Klasha mastered four compulsory languages, Dutch, French, German, and English. After she finished school, she worked as a bookkeeper. Klasha met her husband-to-be, Hendrik Van Guens, Hank, through her sports activities. They began what would be a long courtship. In 1940, Hitler invaded Holland, and life changed drastically. Hank joined the underground resistance movement. Klasha continued to work, but also became part of the resistance. She and many other young women were messengers, riding on their bikes, often for 100 kilometers or more, to deliver messages to groups of workers hidden away. One of the people helped through the resistance was a young Canadian, Frank McGee, who was the only survivor of a plane crash. Holland was liberated by the Canadian forces in 1945. Clasha and Hank were married in 1946, and in the following years, 2 daughters were born. In 1953, Frank McGee offered to sponsor them to come to Canada, and they arrived to live in the Silver Creek area, working on the Stewart farm. Clasha faced many challenges, used to city living, the sawdust-burning cook stove, the wood stove for heat, the hand water pump, and the outside bathroom were all new to her. Baking was new to her too, but she mastered that with the help of a Robin Hood cookbook. In fact, she did so well that she entered her bread in the fall fair and won prizes. She also won prizes for her crocheting and knitting. Clasha sewed most of the clothing for her family. Hank found work at Federated Co-op, where he eventually became a lumber grader. Clasha went back to work when the 2 daughters were in school. The Van Guens bought a home near Salmon Arm. They learned to golf, continued to dance and play tennis, as well as building a boat and learning to water ski. They enjoyed camping and fishing. Clasha and Hank built a house at Raven Subdivision. They were over 50 when they took up skiing. Clasha would ski 4 times a week, twice with Hank and twice with lady friends. The ladies were dubbed with the name Mountain Mafia by a newspaper reporter, and the name stuck. The Van Guens returned to Holland many times through the years, and Clasha's family often came to visit in Canada. After retiring, Hank and Clasha bought a motorhome and traveled across Canada. The motorhome was handy, too, for those ski trips. Both Clasha and Hank were healthy all their lives, and when Hank suffered a fatal heart attack in 1987, it was a terrible blow for his family, who did not even have time to say goodbye. With her indomitable spirit, Clasha carried on, but she gave up many of the activities she had shared with Hank. Clasha moved into a care home in her later years. She enjoyed the social activities there. She loved to read mystery stories and shared her apartment with her cat, Allie, who she took for walks every day. She still loved to knit and crochet. Clasha passed away in 2016 at the age of 97. It was a full life. Fred Kosky, pioneer of the shoe swap, written and read by Estelle Noakes from an interview with Fred. Fred Kosky was a true pioneer of the shoe swap. He was born in 1919 in the old Salmon Arm Hospital that his mother described as a chicken coop. Friends and relatives were of great importance to Fred, and he was respected for his honesty, integrity, and a willingness to lend a hand in any situation. Fred received a Good Samaritan Award, and it was well deserved. Fred's Finnish grandparents, John and Susanna, arrived at Canoe in the late 1800s. They homesteaded at Engineers Point, as did 3 of their sons when they came of age. The Kosky family also obtained land at Tappan, White Lake, and Notch Hill, playing a major part in the settlement and development of the shoe swap. Fred's father, Otto, was a section foreman for the CPR. Fred went to school at shoe swap, where his father was stationed, until grade 4. The family then moved back to Canoe. Fred finished his schooling at Canoe Creek School. His chores as a boy were to help look after the pigs, chicken, cows, and horses. He also helped on the farm with the orchards and haying, as well as working in the packing house. After finishing school, Fred worked for the Canoe Mill and logged with his brothers before buying a taxi. The taxi was used for emergencies too, and Fred had some fascinating stories to tell about his taxi driving days. Fred married Daisy Worthington, a local girl, in 1940. It was a close relationship that lasted for 64 years. Dancing, fishing, and gardening were some of their most loved pastimes. Daisy was a wonderful cook, and their home was always full of relatives and friends. They had three children, Myrna, John, and Linda. Fred enlisted in 1943. After training, he was shipped overseas and spent his war years in France, Holland, and Germany. He was part of the transportation division, delivering supplies and transporting the wounded. Fred had some hair-raising tales to tell about his war years. After his return to Canoe in 1946, Fred worked for a short time for the CPR and then for sawmills at Perry River, Golden, and Lumbee, before working for the school board in Lumbee and Vernon until his retirement. Fred and Daisy moved back to the North Broadview area in Salmon Arm. They continued to garden, fish, and enjoy their friends and family. When Daisy's health began to fail, they moved to Heronview. Daisy eventually entered Pioneer Lodge. Fred, after living with his daughter for a short time, moved to Piccadilly Terrace. Daisy passed away in 2004. Fred's daughter Linda passed away in 1998 and his son John in 2002. Although Fred had seen many sad times, he had a wonderful sense of humor and an infectious laugh, and he had a positive approach to life that made him a joy to be around. Fred passed away in 2011. This story on Tom and Olive Gray was written by Estelle Noakes and is read by Estelle Noakes from Interviews with Tom and Olive Gray. Thomas Gray III was born on the family farm at Mara in 1910. Tom's ancestors originated from Yorkshire, England, and began homesteading in the Mara area in 1886. Olive's parents were originally from Ireland and Denmark. Olive, née Fenton, was born in 1918 at Enderby, where her family farmed. She met Tom at a schoolhouse dance. They were married in 1940. Both loved to dance, and that became a big part of their social life. As well, they were an active part of the Mara Community Club, played golf, and participated in many other pursuits through the years. Tom and Olive took over Tom's family farm in 1940. Like most farmers of that era, they raised various animals for their own use, sold cream, and harvested their own crops, as well as cultivating a big garden. They raised pigs very successfully, and with the proceeds, they were able to build a new house. It was a rewarding and very busy life for the Grays. Their son, Murray, now runs the farm along with grandson Chad. The farm was commemorated in 2005 with a plaque for being in operation for over 100 years. The Grays had a varied and interesting life with many adventures. Travel was very important to them, and they explored a good part of Canada and the United States, as well as England, Ireland, and Scotland. They also enjoyed 4 boat cruises. Both Olive and Tom loved to camp and fish, and their truck and camper was one of the most traveled in Canada. They spent many good times fishing for salmon on the ocean and touring Shuswap Lake by boat. Their home was always the gathering place for family and friends. Tom and Olive Gray enjoyed more than 60 years of marriage. The Grays had many wonderful memories and loads of stories to tell. Their sons, Murray and Norm, lived close by, as well as 3 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren. It was a busy and full life. Tom and Olive have both passed away in recent years. Mamie Reynolds, written by Estelle Noakes, read by Estelle Noakes from Interviews with Mamie. Mamie Margaret Hill was born on April 29, 1922, on her parents' farm at Glen Eden. Mamie's father, Victor Thomas Hill, came to Canada to work on the railway at the end of the 19th century. Many Finnish immigrants settled in the Glen Eden area in the early 1900s, forming a close-knit farming community. Vic had built up a nice little farm on his 100 acres. In fact, the community called it the village, as it had so many buildings: barn, stable, packing house, chicken house, pigsty, pump house, etc. They also had 5 acres of orchard. Mamie learned at a young age to work hard. She remembers yodeling the cows home, and she and her mother did most of the milking. One of the cows didn't like men. Mamie helped in all aspects of farm work as well as in the orchard and garden. On Saturday, she helped her mother clean the house, wash clothes, and cook. She remembered once at the age of 8, when she was supposed to be looking after her young brother, Reno, she left him to go to the outhouse, nicknamed the Rinky Dinky Toilet, and got carried away looking at the Eden's catalogue. Interrupted by a cry from Reno, she went out and found him with a bloody mouth. He had 4 teeth kicked out by a horse, and they never grew back. Mamie had a fear of rats, which began when the Hills had a pack rat in the attic of the house. One night when Mamie was about 12, she woke up to the pack rat licking her head. She was very relieved when her father caught the rat the next day. At the age of 16, she started working for the Salmon Arm Exchange, where apples and tomatoes were packed. She worked there until she married 10 years later. But there was time for fun, too. Finnish parents encouraged their children to participate in sports. A group of young people from the community would tramp up the mountain, at least 3 miles, to the forestry lookout cabin, now long gone. They would stay overnight and ski down through the trees. This was quite a feat, as their homemade skis were without metal edges and offered very little control. Mamie skied well into her retirement years. Mamie also played softball and was the back catcher in a ball field right across from their house. As a child, she attended an old log schoolhouse built by the pioneers at the site of the current fire hall on 40th Avenue. She remembered being caught chewing gum and the embarrassment of having to stand in front of the class with it pasted on her nose. She said she was a geeky girl and more than once had to write 50 times, "I will not giggle in school." Mamie always loved music and played guitar, accordion, mouth organ, and piano. In 1943, a fire burnt down the Hills' outbuildings. Only the house stood. The animals were saved, and Mamie remembered milking the cows outside in the runway to the burnt barn. In 1948, at the age of 26, Mamie married for the first time, leaving Glen Eden for Port Renfrew. Her marriage didn't last, and the couple separated. Mamie moved back to Salmon Arm with her 2 sons around 1978. Living with her sister, Elizabeth Dunn, she found a job as a chambermaid at the Shuswap Inn. In 1980, Mamie married Wilf Reynolds. They were both then in their late 50s. It was a happy marriage, and they enjoyed many good times. She said he was a very kind man. They enjoyed dancing, curling in the Legion, bond spills, and liked to explore the back roads and mountains in their truck, fishing in the lakes. Mamie and Wilf had been married for 5 years when he suffered a fatal heart attack at the age of 64. Mamie finished the home she and Wilf had been building together and lived there for the next 20 years. She maintained a small farm and kept a big garden and orchard until she sold the property in 2006 and moved into Piccadilly Terrace. A volunteer at the mental health thrift store for many years, Mamie not only drove but maintained her own car as well. The mother of 2 sons, she is one of just 3 remaining descendants of Glen Eden's pioneer families. There were many adjustments for Mamie through her life, but she handled them well. She missed living in the country, driving animals, and cooking for friends in her own kitchen, but she still had many friends from the old days and always had a smile for the new ones, too. Mamie passed away in 2007. A life well lived. The story of Marie Taylor was written by Estelle Noakes and is read by Estelle Noakes from Interviews with Marie Taylor. Marie Taylor has three children, David, Linda, and Robert, five grandchildren, and one great-grandchild. A generous volunteer, she always gave freely of her time, energy, and expertise to those less fortunate. Born Marie Salo in 1935, her identical twin Miriam was born minutes later. 10 years later, another set of twins, Elma and Anna, completed the Salo family. Marie's mother, Martha, was a descendant of Finnish pioneers who settled the White Lake area. Her father, Laurie, arrived from Finland in 1934. Marie graduated from J.L. Jackson, moved with Miriam to Kamloops to work, and married Dennis Taylor in 1955. It was the first real separation for the twins and very difficult for them both. Dennis worked in logging and the Taylors owned a farm for some years, then moved to Kamloops in 1968, where Dennis worked for BC Tal as a lineman for 35 years. He was injured a few times, once so badly they didn't expect him to live, and Marie sat by his bed for over 2 months. An excellent seamstress, Marie worked for dry cleaners for 10 years. She volunteered extensively for Meals on Wheels, Canada Lifeline, the Hug a Bear program, and the Heart Cushion program. Marie was a pioneer partner in Overlander Council of Telephone, Pioneers of America. In 1991, she was the recipient of the Pioneer Partner of the Month Award for all of Canada. This organization's motto is answering the call of those in need. She was commended for her cheerfulness and cooperation. Holidays were spent camping and fishing throughout BC and Alberta. Marie's twin and best friend Miriam died in 1996, a devastating blow for Marie. In 2003, Marie had triple bypass surgery and suffered a surgery-induced stroke. Dennis became ill with emphysema and passed away in 2004. They had been married 49 years. Marie, still suffering the effects of the stroke, moved into a retirement home. She enjoyed living there and helping with the entertainment. Marie passed away in 2012. The story was written by Estelle Noakes and is read by Estelle Noakes from Interviews with Lloyd and Shirley Stewart. The Stewarts were longtime residents of Salmon Arm. Lloyd arrived with his family at the age of 12. Shirley's Finnish grandparents settled at Glen Eden in the early 1900s. Love and laughter surrounded the over 60-year marriage of this most congenial couple. Their focus through the years was on family, friends, and volunteering in the community they loved. They had 4 children, 8 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. Shirley was born in Victoria. When she was 7, her father died, and her mother moved her back to Glen Eden. Shirley learned to work hard at an early age, helping on the farm, in the garden, and the home. But living in the Finnish community provided entertainment too, and Shirley enjoyed a variety of sports and activities. Her mother remarried, and another sister completed the family. When Shirley finished grade 10, she went to work at the packing house in Salmon Arm, and about this time, her family moved next to the Stewart farm. Lloyd was born in Saskatchewan, the second eldest of 8 children. His farmer family moved many times before settling just west of Salmon Arm. Lloyd grew up helping on the farm. As a lad, he developed an illness that was diagnosed as polio, and this slowed him down considerably. But he continued to play sports and help with the farm work. Lloyd finished grade 10 and then, besides helping on his father's farm, worked for International Fisheries. Later, he worked for Noons and helped to construct 3 area schools. Lloyd had gone to school with Shirley at Glen Eden, where his family briefly lived. Later, after her family moved next door, they reacquainted and soon were courting. They married in 1948, first living with Lloyd's parents and then buying their own farm, now DeMille's. They began with a dairy farm, switching fairly quickly to a beef operation. Besides farming, Lloyd worked at Noka Dairies, starting as the cream truck driver and after 25 years ending as manager. The Stewart farm also grew its own chickens, turkeys, and pigs, as well as a large garden. Shirley and Lloyd added 3 girls, Evelyn, Carol, and Donna, and a son, Douglas, to their family. Through their busy lives, they found time to play, too. Both loved to curl and golf. Lloyd once recorded a hole-in-one on the golf course, and Shirley's curling team came in 3rd in BC Ladies' Championships in the late 60s. In addition, they served their community. Lloyd was a director for the credit union. Shirley belonged to the Valley Women's Institute for over 40 years and canvassed for many organizations. Shirley was on the board that was instrumental in building Pioneer Lodge. Shirley and Lloyd spent many happy years in their motorhome. They loved to camp and fish. Actually, Shirley crocheted and left the fishing to Lloyd. They also traveled internationally and within Canada. At home, Shirley loved to cook, and many friends remember the fun times around the Stewart table, either eating or playing games. Lloyd is well known for his sense of humor and his pranks. They sold the farm to DeMille's in 1981 and then built a nice home just across the Salmon River. After 17 years in this home, they moved into a house in Salmon Arm. Shortly after, Lloyd fell and broke his hip. It was a slow recovery, hampered in part by his childhood illness, plus his rough and tumble work for fisheries and on the farm. The Stewarts moved into a retirement home in their later years and enjoyed the social aspect of the retirement home. Shirley and Lloyd celebrated their 60th anniversary in 2008. Lloyd passed away in 2010 and Shirley in 2012.
For more information on these and other stories, please contact the Salmon Arm Museum at Haney Heritage Park or visit us when we are open during the summer season.
Manor Cross Country Ski Club, a small club with a big heart. This story is by Estelle Noakes and members of the Skamana Cross Country Ski Club. Skamana Lakes lie just north of Loken Bear Creek Road, which is 14 kilometers from the village of Chase or 8 kilometers off the Adams Lake Road. The two lakes and surrounding area offer a delightful multi-purpose recreational area with skiing, snowshoeing, and sledding in winter, camping, fishing, hiking, biking, and horseback riding in summer. In the early logging days, Adams River Lumber Company diverted the creek, damming the lake for a flume that transported logs down to the Adams River. Later, the area was used as a Japanese work camp during World War II. The old buildings have just recently been bulldozed, and a biathlon training area was set up, although there is no evidence of its actual use in the 1970s. The origins of Skamana Lakes as a winter recreational area began in the early 1980s, when a group from the Chase and Pritchard including the Spencer, Crema, Clark, Love, McLellan, Hoechlin, Grube, Hutchings, and Boscher families, were searching for a winter recreational area for cross-country skiing and a tobogganing hill. The first area they tried was the Nisqually Meadows, and they skied and tobogganed there for a few years. Gene Jinks, along with sons Hamish and Ian, provided ski lessons for the children. The area proved not satisfactory due to the early disappearing and sometimes absent snow. Roger Bean, a teacher from Chase High School, who had been instrumental in the planning for the biathlon at Skamana Lakes, had some good maps, and it was soon discovered as Skamana Lakes lay in a snow belt. An informal recreational area was set up at Skamana Lakes. To enable the club to track the ski hills, Don and Eileen Boscher supplied a snowmobile. The home-fashioned tracking equipment was such that someone had to sit on it to weigh it down, a very precarious perch. When the snowmobile turned out to be inadequate, the Boschers lent the club $5,000 for the purchase of a Yamaha snowmobile. The club, through fundraising, which included logging, and later through assisting at casinos, was able to pay off the debt. An old cabin was donated by Quail Lodge, hauled to Skamana, and put on the west side of West Skamana Lake near the road to the Forest Service recreational site. It made a cozy warm-up hut until 2001, when it was burned down by vandals. A new hut was built down in the meadows, which is not accessible to road traffic. The builders for the cabin were John Thornbury and George Carlin, with the assistance of many club members. With the money raised from casinos, the club was able to afford better tracking equipment. Ted Kay, who was president at that time, was instrumental in the purchase of a bombardier and trail groomer to track the trails. He did the tracking for many years and looked after the maintenance of the equipment, a position which George Carlin took over for many years. The old Bombardier served with Skamana Ski Club for over 20 years, was replaced by a Ginzu groomer and new tracking equipment in 2010. The fundraising for the new equipment was spearheaded in the capable hands of Brian David, then president of the club. Skamana Cross Country Ski Club has been a member of Cross Country BC for over 22 years. Daryl Spencer was instrumental in the club becoming a society on August 1st in 1990. From 1988 and for 12 years, a Jackrabbit ski program was sponsored by Skamana. Several levels of classes were offered, and some children placed highly in provincial competitions. In the mid-90s, there was about 30 children in Jackrabbits and four coaches. A key to the success of the club was the starting line in Chase, owned by Brian and Trish David. The store, for many years, was an info center for the club and as well sold and rented skis. The Jackrabbit program ended when there was a lack of children using the program, coinciding with a lack of volunteer coaches. Some of the coaches who contributed were Kathy Hoplin, Jim McCown, Gene Jenks, Ian and Hamish Jenks, Kathy Spencer, Ann Grube, John Thornbury, Michael Zwolak, Phil McIntyre-Paul, and Brian Kay. Skamana is a delightful skiing destination. The 18 kilometers of groomed trails wind around the lakes and through forest and meadows along old logging roads. The trails range from beginner to advanced. In addition, there is a myriad of possibilities for those who wish to ski on ungroomed pathways. Trails for snowshoeing are offered as well, and with the help of the Shuswap Trail Alliance, substantially more snowshoe trails were opened for the season of 2011 and 2012, with more opening in following years. To reflect the growing enthusiasm for snowshoeing, The club has changed its name to Skamana Cross Country Ski and Snowshoe Club. Tobogganing hills are near the parking lot, and a small one is near the cabin. The Skamana Lakes area is co-managed between Recreation Sites and Trails BC and Skamana Cross Country Ski Club. A forest recreation site is on West Skamana Lake with picnic tables and toilets. The info center for the club is G-Force in Chase. What has sustained Skamana Ski Club for more than 30 years has been the many volunteers who have given so much of their time and energy. They are too numerous to mention, but those who have been exceptional. In addition to those mentioned earlier are Jim McClellan, Kathy Hopland, John Thornbury, George Carlin, Ken Sparrow, Ron Fairhurst, Ken Shaw, Darcy and Patricia Simpson, and Brian David. The one person who has been a member since Skamana Ski Club's inception, supported the club in all its endeavors, and continues to do so is Eileen Boscher. The club's membership has been around 100, but many other people ski and snowshoe by donation. Members come from the wide surrounding area of Chase, Adams Lake, Pritchard, North Shuswap, and Sorrento, with many guests from further afield. Skamana Cross Country Ski Club is a small and homey club. Christmas is celebrated with a potluck, complete with mulled wine and a live candle tree to sing carols beside. Valentine's Day features a chilly potluck, mushy valentines, and an evening ski. Skamana is a magical area for winter and summer recreation. Just a bit off the beaten track, a place of solitude and peace. Come join us.
So before winter set in, we created a large living room with a bedroom above with a good solid floor. Then on one side of the old building, we made a kitchen with a sink and hand pump, for water was only 4 feet below the surface, and also a storeroom, pantry, and a bathroom. On the other side of the main building, we had a hall and a front door with a bedroom on the one side and a staircase up to the dormitory for the boys. We had shipped 3.5 tons of favorite pieces, corner cupboard, mahogany, drop-leaf table, 2 tall boys, piano, and cello, so when all that arrived 3 months after we arrived, we were quite at home. The logs of the old building were well and truly caulked with mud, moss, and straw, yet a bush rat visited us each night during our first few days. For some reason, I was deputed to stop this little game. One night, when everyone else was in bed, Brother Evelyn lit the lantern and put it near the bottom of the stairs. He gave me the loaded .22, told me to lie flat on the floor, and upon hearing the rat plunking down the steps, to balance the muzzle of the rifle between my toes, take a good aim, and pull the trigger. He said I was to pick the bush rat up by the tip of its tail and drop him into the still-burning heater, or his fleas would leave him and cause further trouble. As soon as all was quiet, I heard the horrible, ghostly plunk, 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 and there he was sitting at the foot of the stairs, gazing at the flickering flame as if hypnotized. Satisfied that it meant him no harm, he sat down comfortably and preened his whiskers. Then suddenly there was a terrific report, and to my horrified gaze, he was lying on his back, feebly kicking his forelegs in the air. I swear I never took aim or pulled the trigger. We got the occasional duck and deer, and when a hunting neighbor shot a bear, we received a few nice steaks. The deer were hung up in our big fir tree to freeze. It was to be lowered, a piece sawn off at a time when we needed it, and hauled up again away from the dogs and the cougars. Our first cow was found to produce a bucket full of very watery-looking milk. She jumped the fences and was very fond of the blue water and socks on washing day. So as soon as possible, we got a Jersey cow, which presented us with the necessary cream for our butter, and enough was left to sell at the creamery at Salmon Arm. While walking down the road one evening to visit a neighbor, I received a shock. I saw a bear and cub crossing only a few yards away. So I did as I was told, turned around and walked quietly home. It was very soon clear that the four older girls could not stay at home eating up the small profits, so Mother took me to Revelstoke, where I got a job in the real estate office at a princely salary of $60 a month. There we found a nice family for me to live with. Although we had come to Canada on account of Dad's health, we lost him early in 1908 through peritonitis, he having refused an appendectomy. Mother had always kept a well-stocked medicine cabinet, and being a member of the St. John's Ambulance Society, she was ready and able to help anyone. One day, a neighbor fetched her to see his wife, who was expecting their first baby, and she sent him to bring the new doctor, who had a nice house built in Salmon Arm, which overlooked the lake. Nearing our place, our neighbor, Mr. Brown, said to the doctor, "There are five girls at the Elgwood home." "It was Mrs. Elgood who sent me for you. You should look them over, Doc." The doctor was a well-built man with thick black hair and violet blue eyes, pink cheeks, and a well-trimmed pointed beard. He and Mr. Brown took Mother on to the Browns' place, and the doctor and Mother walked the short distance back 2 hours, and he stayed for the evening meal. He also proved to be a wonderful conversationalist, but stole my photo in a small silver frame from the top of the piano. Then Brother Guy drove him back to Salmon Arm. Next morning, I returned to Revelstoke. 2 days later, when the doctor had bought a horse and a buggy, he drove up to see Mary Brown and popped in to see Mother, whom he astounded by telling her his circumstances and asking her kind permission to woo her daughter Gladys. That was me. She gave him her permission, and he returned the frame of the stolen picture. So that was the beginning of a whirlwind courtship, mostly by mail. Dr. Patty Beale and I were married at Revelstoke on June 28, 1909, because I wished to be married on Dad's birthday, which had been his and Mother's wedding day in 1882. Mother, a brother, and sister had come up for the event. Then we had lunch at a cafe and caught the afternoon train. The others went on to Salmon Arm, but Patty and I alighted at Sycamoose, where his motorboat was tied up, and off we went to the two-tent camp he had set up on the foreshore of an orchard about a half mile from town. This was from Gladys Elgood Beale, from Making History, an anthology of British Columbia, edited and published by Millicent A. Lindo, 1974.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceoftheshuswap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.